Welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Gallegos, here with
Jeff Rappaport.
And today is a very special episode, guys. We have Jeff Braleo back in the house. Thank you for being here, Jeff.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
We greatly appreciate it. And so I want to provide some context behind this. But first, let's kind of, our last show that we had you on, we were kind of talking about how wholesaling here in Utah was becoming illegal, so to speak.
Unlicensed activity.
There we go. So I want to continue that conversation, and then today we're going to be talking about trusts and some legal ways to wholesale, right? So Jeff, Jeff Rappaport, let's provide some context.
We got two Jeffs on today, yes.
Jeff squared.
So actually, I just had Jeff come to the local RIA just a couple of days ago, and you literally did this presentation. And I did learn some things about you, by the way, that you're a former marathon winner and a former Ironman contestant. So
yep,
that was
true.
Pretty cool. But we talked about some different kinds of trusts, and what I really want to talk, I want to give everyone a brief overview of why you would even need to get involved with trusts. But I love how it pertains to, you know, we have people out there doing creative financing deals where they're buying and holding properties, and there's some different kinds of trusts that they could use, one to protect themselves, one to kind of conceal and keep themselves private from the rest of the world. So I thought this would be a great episode to kind of dive into. And then you're always a wealth of knowledge that we'd love to start recommending our people to come, you know, if they have questions, to come directly to you.
Perfect. Awesome.
Yeah. So let's first talk about what happened here in Utah with the Board of Realtors.
It's the Division of Real Estate.
Okay.
And they, in the last couple of years, they've been taking a stronger look at the practice of wholesaling. It was something that kind of struck them out of the blue. They were, you know, they had never heard anything about it, but then they were seeing transactions, and to them it looked like huge fraud, huge illegality. So they started taking a deeper dive into it. And so they started looking at the transaction itself of going under contract, then assigning that contract to another end buyer. And so the way that the Utah Division of Real Estate looks at that is that there is a person, the wholesaler, who is connecting a seller with a buyer, mm-hmm. which is the job of a real estate agent. That's what real estate agents do. They find listings and work with sellers, and then they find the buyer for that listing. So the Utah Division initially was like, okay, this is a licensed activity. Mm-hmm. So we went through the rounds for about 2 years, and the end result and the current status as of today is that the division does consider it a licensed activity because they are connecting a buyer and seller together for the expectation of a fee or some kind of compensation. There are legal issues with that definition that are still being worked out, whether or not it truly would be a licensed activity. And that's the debate that's going on throughout the country, is most divisions of real estate throughout the U.S. do consider it a licensed activity. But there are some, you know, there's some constitutionality issues there where if you have a contract, you have this right. It's a constitutional right to own this right to buy the house. And the division can't restrict you, a government can't restrict you from transferring that right to somebody else. And so, you know, there's issues like that, but at the end of the day, especially here in Utah, most divisions of real estate are very heavy-handed. They're the iron law. They sort of do what they can, and they pull everything under licensing. So it's very difficult to kind of get what you want out of that. So current status is, in Utah, you really need a license to assign a contract.
And if I understand correctly, that's exactly what you came back with after spending quite a bit of time. But then they came out, the Division of Real Estate came out with something that really said, if you were licensed, you really can't do this
because there's
a conflict between when you change the intent from being a buyer to now you're assigning and you were licensed. And
what they did is they said, fine, the initial was, yes, it's a licensed activity, you need a license because you're acting as a real estate agent. But then the second problem that came up, and they're still dealing with this, is that when you're negotiating with a seller as a buyer, you have no fiduciary responsibility to the seller to protect them and their interest and their value and all that, because you're acting as a buyer. But then the second you turn around and wholesale that contract to somebody else, and if the division says, no, this is a licensed activity where you do have a fiduciary responsibility to the seller, now suddenly, how do you impute this responsibility to a seller after you've already negotiated and signed the contract?
Right.
And now you've got to protect the seller and maximizing the value for their house and all these other things. And they didn't really realize that.
Yep.
So they kind of forced everybody into a system, then realized once they forced them into the system, they forced them to violate other rules.
Right.
So now it's a kind of a mess of how they're going to resolve this in a way that doesn't violate other things down the line, because the statutes weren't designed to cover this situation.
Yes.
That's the problem. Yep. And they're trying to apply inappropriate statutes to the transaction. And it's not working out very well.
Well, and I want to be clear, even though that we're talking specifically about what's going on in Utah, this is to some degree happening in most markets across the country. I know Florida's
Texas banned it outright.
Texas, no assignments.
No assignments,
Florida has been an issue. Ohio has been an issue. And it's happening to some degree everywhere.
Right.
And it probably, if it's not a big deal where you're at, it probably will be at some point.
In the future.
Yeah.
In the future.
Yep.
Good point. So how do we use trust to do it creatively?
Well, let's back up for a second, because we kind of got ahead of ourselves with the wholesaling thing. So what I want to do is talk about trust in general first. Some of the different kinds, why you would want to use one instead of another, that kind of thing. And then we'll tie it back in. I know I don't want you to give you can't give an opinion exactly how you're going to do this to wholesale, but we'll give you some general ideas.
I can speak in general terms.
Yes.
How things work.
You mean an attorney can't give legal advice over it? I understand. All right, so let's talk.
Trust generally.
Yeah, trust generally. Okay. So
the nice thing about a trust, as opposed to a partnership or a limited liability company or even corporation, those are business entities, LLCs, FLPs, family limited partnerships, corporations, and all of those business entities have to be registered with the state of formation. And almost all states have at least a bare minimum of information that's required in association with that. So when you register those with the state, your name's probably going to be somewhere on it or an address. There's some public information associated with those entities. Trusts, on the other hand, are not considered business entities and they're not registered with any state. So it's a purely private document that you don't have to release to anybody except under subpoena, as a general rule. When you start using them in real estate, yes, you'll give them your title company so they can do the closing and things like that, but it's a private document.
Yep.
And so who owns that trust is completely private, who created that trust is completely private. And the only thing that would be public is if this trust owned a piece of real estate on the county land records, title, that we call it, it would show either the name of the trust or the name of the trustee of the trust, depending on the state you live in. But who owns that trust is completely private. And so there's no way to connect that house to a human being if it's done correctly.
Cool.
So let's talk about a couple of different trusts, and hopefully everyone caught that last bit of the description, because I mean that's huge when
yeah.
you can remain basically anonymous. I mean that's what you want.
Yeah, in real estate there are two P's that we have to think about: privacy and protection.
Yeah.
Those are the key things that all real estate investors are looking for.
And actually, depending on what type of trust, you're going to get one or the other, or both.
That's
right.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about just a few different trusts. And
okay.
We're not going to go too deep into all this, but let's talk about some of the trusts.
Okay. We'll start with sort of the transactional trust that most real estate investors are going to run into if they want to use trusts. Most real estate circles will call it the land trust because that's the terminology that has flooded the real estate educational market. Everybody talks about land trust.
Yeah.
A land trust is a specific kind of trust that is authorized by state statute. So Florida has a land trust statute. Illinois, which was the original one, has a land trust statute. And a few other states have adopted that. So in those states, they actually have something called a land trust.
Yeah.
And it's specifically designed for holding real estate. The other states that do not have this statute obviously then do not have anything called a land trust because it's not authorized by law. So what we've done in the other states is created a very simple, it's called an inter vivos, which is just like a family living trust term, but it's just a very simple trust that is set up for the single purpose of holding title to real estate. And the structure of it looks like any other trust. The structure does not look like a land trust, though. There are some key differences in how those trusts are created.
Okay.
But it's a very simple trust. It's something that, you know, once you've got a form for it, there's a little bit of a learning curve. But once you get past that learning curve, it's a very simple document that you can fill out, sign, get notarized, and you've created this trust that you can either use to hold title to real estate or to facilitate other kinds of real estate investment transactions like wholesaling or seller finance deals or other creative situations where privacy is key.
Okay, and you would call that what? Either a land trust?
We call it an asset holding trust is what we call it here.
Okay.
And the way we do it, I've heard other names about it, but yes, because its entire purpose is to hold a single asset, which is real estate. So we just call it an asset holding trust.
Okay, and this is where we're going to spend most of our time. But real quick, let's talk about a couple of the other types of trusts, because now you're going to talk more asset protection.
Right, yeah. Beyond sort of the transactional stuff, yeah. So the other trust that most real estate investors will at some point need and use is a family living trust. This is an estate planning document. It is for the control of assets. It also does, it's kind of secondarily provide some protections, which is nice. But it is the document that controls your assets when you die. But without it, your estate ends up in probate in court, and your estate becomes public information. There's public notices, and then people can chime in and see what you own and stuff like that. And there's many cases of very wealthy, famous people who died without a trust set up, and now the whole world knows exactly what is in their estate.
Right.
So the family living trust is a privacy document. There's some protections with it, and it's a control document.
Okay.
The other kind of trust is an irrevocable or asset protection kind of trust. These are super solid, incredibly bulletproof trusts designed specifically to protect assets. They're also private, so they do private, because as a trust, it's not registered anywhere, so it's a private document. But its core function is to act as a holding company for all kinds of assets, not just real estate. So cash accounts, stock brokerage accounts, personal residences, and these other assets that you may have that aren't necessarily part of your real estate investing business.
Okay.
And so for real estate investors, they'll stick with this asset holding trust, which is something they use every day in the real estate investing world, their family living trust, which is an estate planning document they set up for their family, and then those with the asset level and the estate values that want extra protection, they'll kick in that asset protection trust to kind of hold everything.
Okay.
So can you make an asset holding trust revocable?
It's an irrevocable trust, which is where the protection comes from.
Okay.
But there are ways to revoke it. Utah, the Utah Asset Protection Trust, as long as all the beneficiaries, which is usually the people that set it up, so it's usually you that sets up this trust to hold your assets, that you can still enjoy. So you still get the enjoyment of those assets, the money from those assets. But to dissolve this trust, all the beneficiaries need to agree, which is usually not a problem because it's you, maybe you and your spouse, and many clients with still kids on there because they'll actually start transferring wealth to children through this trust, but they don't want the kids to have access to the money because they obviously can't handle it. Or their kids may be drug addicts or something like that, so they can hold this in trust for their kids. So as long as all those beneficiaries agree to dissolve the trust, you can actually dissolve the trust and take assets back out.
Okay, interesting.
So what one of the things, and I want to make it clear that we're not going to do an asset protection episode.
Right.
However, it's super important to understand. So I'm going to ask you just like two questions, and then I want to move on back to the first trust, the land trust.
Asset holding trust.
So should you ever own property in your own name?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Ever.
Because now everything that you own is potentially at risk.
Public.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's not only public, your name is public and everyone knows that you own it, but because of different kinds of liability, that asset is going to be at risk if something happens to you. Like if you're in a car accident, sure, you kill a family of five, that's a big lawsuit against you.
Yep.
And if they can find that asset, they're going to try and go after it.
Okay.
So we're talking about protecting that asset. And if it's in your personal name, there's no protection.
So there's always levels of protection.
Absolutely.
So the next level, I think the most elementary level is have a company, right?
An LLC.
Is that enough? I mean, what's all this trust stuff? Let's just start a company and we're fine.
Right. The way we do things here is, and you know, I've been in this game for over 20 years and I've gone to all the big national seminars and some lawyer will walk out on the stage with a silver briefcase and say, here's your asset protection bulletproof package and it's got the asset protection trust and the land trust and the corporation and all these things. And then clients come to me like, I have no idea what I'm doing with all of this.
Yeah.
So they spent all this money for all these different types of vehicles and they don't know anything about them or how to use them.
Sure.
We typically grow with clients. I mean, our clients are with us long term. We don't show up somewhere, sell something and disappear. So for most real estate investors, the very first thing they're going to do is set up that LLC.
Yeah.
Right? They'll set up one if they're flippers or wholesalers or real estate agents, you know, and this is kind of a tax savings thing. So they'll set that up. Yeah. Or if they're going to hold real estate, rental properties and be a landlord, then they'll set up the LLC for hold. And when you first start off, that's great.
Yeah.
That really is. That's all you need.
Yeah.
You know, just get that first LLC set up, get rental and learn how to run it and learn how to run that business. Then as you start to pick up more rentals, then you can start thinking, you know what, you know, I think I want to start looking at some privacy. So maybe you'll start this asset holding trust and start holding title, especially with your seller finance deals.
Yep.
Great way to pick up seller finance deals.
Yep.
And you'll start picking privacy in the asset holding trust, and that trust is owned by the LLC that owns all your other property. So you still just have your LLC, but you're holding title in this trust that keeps it private. That's a great next step. Now you're building up more and more assets, you've done some flips, you've got some cash accounts, maybe you're going to start being a little bit of a private money lender, and you've got your personal residence. So then as you start building wealth, then definitely get that family living trust, you know, protect your kids and all that.
Yep.
And then we can add on an additional layer of really solid protection. And one option is the family limited partnership. It's just a partnership agreement. It's we've been using it for over 100 years in the U.S. that the wealthy have used to protect assets. Or if you live in certain states with these asset protection trusts, we can use the trust as well. So those are kind of higher level, bigger bulletproof techniques for those with the assets that justify it.
And it can be, I mean, one property is, you know, you could own a property that has a lot of equity or free and clear.
Free and clear.
You know, you want to protect that particular piece of property. Or you could start building and you own three or four or five rentals, in which case, you know, you probably need some help determining should they all be owned by the same company.
How we split that up and divide it. Yeah, when we have conversations about, we'll ask them how many rentals you own, how much equity is in each one. In Utah, in about 16 or 17 states, they do have something called the Series LLC, mm-hmm. which is just the go-to vehicle for holding a portfolio of rental properties.
Sure.
It's like somebody created specifically for us. Other states don't have that yet, and so we use different structures like a family limited partnership as a holding company and then just create a new LLC for every single property.
Yeah.
So there's options there.
So, but if you're literally holding any type of property, I mean, whether it's one to a thousand or more, that the more you need to start understanding how to, one, use your company or companies and trusts to start protecting yourself, and how to start creating a maybe an estate plan. So, hey, if something were to happen, you don't have to deal with probate and
publicity of your estate, and your children will squabble and try and challenge things, and someone will say, "Mom said I would have this," and not you. Yeah, it gets ugly.
Well, and your presentation, we had an hour and a half that we could just do it. I mean, it was great in terms of being able to protect yourself. But what I want to do is focus now more on this land trust.
Transactional
asset side holding. Yeah. Just because I think it's going to cater to our listeners, and it's super simple.
Yeah. It's definitely more relevant
for
creative financing.
Correct. So let's talk about one. What are the components of the
trust?
The trust.
Okay. In most states, outside of the land trust states, because those are kind of special beasts. In most states where you're using this kind of asset holding trust, there are three parties involved.
Okay.
There's the grantor, sometimes called the trustor or settlor. Okay. This is just the person that creates it, sets it up, and puts an asset inside.
Yep.
So let's say you are a real estate investor who wants to go pick up a seller financing deal, and you find a good deal, right? And you've negotiated with the seller, and you're ready to kind of sign the contract. So you, the wholesaler, are going to create this trust in order to buy this seller finance deal. So you're the grantor. Now, when I say you, now we just said everyone should have an entity set up, some kind of LLC. It's really going to be your LLC that sets up this trust.
Okay.
Because it's, at the end of the day, going to be owning the property.
Okay.
So that's the grantor, is the person that sets up the trust and sticks the asset inside. What's the asset inside the trust at this point? Just a purchase contract.
Yeah.
That's the only thing this trust owns, is the purchase contract. Eventually it will own a house. But right now, we're just under contract. So the trust is set up to own the purchase contract.
Okay.
So on the as a side note, on the purchase contract, who do you write in as the buyer?
That's a great question.
The trust name itself, or the name of the trustee of the trust. We'll talk about that position next. So, and you don't need to set up the trust. Technically, yes, legal disclaimer, should be set up before the trust signs a contract.
Sure.
But typically, most investors, when they're negotiating with sellers, they don't know if they're going to lock down the deal.
Yeah.
And they're not going to set up all these trusts for every possible deal they get.
Right.
So what they'll do is they'll go into, you know, when they're sitting with the seller, they'll just come up with the name of the trust at that time at the kitchen table.
Yeah.
And they'll usually just name it the property address because that's convenient.
Okay.
So they'll write in the property name, like the 123 Main Street Trust, as the buyer, because they're on 123 Main Street house.
Right.
Okay. So that's what you put on the buyer. And that way, now the trust is the buyer. So the trust owns that REPC, that purchase contract. It has the rights to buy the house. So that's the grantor. Or trustor. The second position is the trustee.
Okay.
The trustee in a trust actually owns legal title to everything. And legal title really just means that they are the controller of what's going on. So the trustee will sign that purchase agreement as trustee. Kind of by way of analogy, let's say you want to buy a house in an LLC, which most people are familiar with.
Sure.
You put the name of the LLC as the buyer, and then you sign the contract as the manager of the LLC.
Right.
Make sense?
Yep.
In a trust, you put the name of the trust as the buyer, and then you sign the contract as the trustee of the trust. So the trustee is like a manager of an entity, and they're the ones that sign paperwork and go to the closing table and, you know, turn on utilities and all of that. So they have the legal rights to act on behalf of this trust and asset.
Okay, so let me ask. So if you're putting together the trust, I'm the grantor.
Mm-hmm.
Now we need someone to act as trustee. Should it also be me?
It certainly can be you.
Okay.
And that's going to depend on how much privacy you really want.
Okay.
States record title in one of two ways. Some states will record title just in the name of the trust.
Okay.
If that's the case, awesome. Those states are great. These trusts work great in those states, because you can be your own trustee and you're still got the privacy, because you're not appearing, your name's not appearing on county land records.
Yeah.
Other states, and Utah is one of them, in those states, county land records are recorded in the name of the trustee of the trust.
Okay.
So that name, that person, is that name's going to end up as public record on county land records.
Which would kind of defeat the purpose,
kind of defeats
right?
the purpose of the privacy. So there are two options. You can find somebody you're choosing. Some will use a relative with a different last name. Some may use a business partner of some sort. And they'll just find another person that can act as their trustee. Now remember, the trustee has to sign things, so they have to be available and be able to...
And you should probably trust them.
And you should definitely trust them, because that trustee does have the legal right to sell the house
correct.
On the back end.
Yeah.
Or the other way to do it is a what is called a commercial fiduciary agent.
Okay.
These are banks, attorneys... In fact, to my knowledge, it's only banks and attorneys, or maybe a commercial outfit, some business that...
You can hire someone to
you
be
can hire
trustee.
Someone to be the trustee. There's usually a small fee, you know, to get set up, and then a small fee for signing different documents. You just provide all the documents to that trustee, they'll sign everything and send it back to you. We do have kind of a subsidiary of our office that it acts as a fiduciary trustee on our client's trust.
Okay.
So if you were to look up that name of that trustee, you're going to find hundreds and hundreds of properties owned by this trustee.
Sure.
So you're completely private because it's us
yeah.
on county land records.
Right. What if, could you create another company and have a company as trustee?
You could create your own LLC or some other entity and make that the trustee. Problem, there's a couple issues with that. The first is one, that LLC is going to be publicly recorded with the state.
Yep.
And there'll be some connection to you with that registration of the LLC. Another thing is it becomes very difficult to sign things because you're going to be signing as a manager on behalf of the LLC, which is the trustee on behalf of the trust.
Got it.
So you've kind of added a very difficult signing situation. What other clients have done have set up their own trust, and that separate trust then becomes the trustee.
Okay.
Now you've got another trust with another signature, and so it does kind of complicate things a little bit more. So most clients, either they've got somebody like Aunt May who lives here in town who is happy to do this, or they hire a commercial private fiduciary to be the trustee. It just okay. makes things a whole lot easier.
Well, and let's be clear. So the trustee needs to be someone that you trust.
Absolutely.
And it needs to be someone, I mean, maybe not always available, but...
Relatively available.
Yeah, yeah. When, hey, I want to sell the property, I need you to come sign some papers.
Yeah.
Does the trustee have any liability?
Trustee has no liability. The trustee only acts as like a manager of the trust.
Sure.
So the trust itself has no real protection. There is, you know, we can, as a little side note here, we can do mention that if you buy a house in these trusts, you're not protected from a lawsuit. Let's say your tenants slip and fall in this house and they want to sue you. It's going blowing right through that trust. But the nice thing is, houses that are titled in a trust, if there's a lawsuit against you, they can't record the judgment against the property. Because you don't own that property,
sure.
the trust does.
That's good.
And so it does prevent liens on the property.
Yep.
It doesn't prevent the lawsuit or them coming after it. It just prevents the lien.
Got it.
Where was I going?
Let's talk about the beneficiary now. So
yeah,
not
the that's
trustee
right.
and
beneficiary.
The grantor.
Yeah, in the way these asset holding trusts are set up, the grantor is just a creator of it. Everything else falls to the beneficiary.
Okay.
And the beneficiary is the true owner of the trust. And they own the equitable rights. Remember how the trustee owns the legal right? That means they get to sign things
okay.
and act as a manager. The beneficiary owns the equitable rights.
They call the shots.
They call the shots. They direct the trustee. Any money belongs to them. Not only does any money belong to them, but any lawsuit is going to flow right onto the beneficiary.
Okay.
So if the tenants do slip and fall and want to sue the trust, it's going to pass right through to the beneficiary.
Okay.
So the beneficiary is on the hook for any lawsuits.
Okay.
But they own the house, so if they sell the house, they get all the proceeds.
Sure.
They own the trust.
Got it. So should the beneficiary be an individual?
No, never.
No. Okay. So the beneficiary
is
the beneficiary
an
should
some
be
court.
Your so LLC.
Your LLC that if it's a flip project, it'll be your LLC that flips houses.
Okay.
If it's a rental property, it'll be your LLC that holds your rentals.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay, so let's talk briefly about To me, there's two major benefits of using this type of trust. One would be staying off public records, mm-hmm. right? Because think about this and tell me if I'm right. If I was to get in a car accident and I own 50 properties, and someone wants to sue me now, they go hire an attorney. What does that attorney go do?
The first thing they're going to do is look at, try and find your assets.
So they're going to put my name into county records yep. and see where it shows up.
That's right.
So if it doesn't show up, there's already one line of defense.
That's right.
And then we'll see how far
they
want
to take. And the attorney's like, wait, they've got no assets. Maybe this case isn't worth pursuing
correct.
At all.
Right. So at least on the surface, it's a line of defense. I used to be taught that whatever you need to do to stay away from the creditors and predators. So so that anonymity is mm-hmm. is very important, and it's super simple. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Are trusts expensive to set up?
No.
Fairly, I mean, when I say fairly, really cheap.
Yeah. Once you get the forms, it's free. Basically.
Right. And you got to go record a warranty.
Yeah, right? $20.
$20 or whatever right. your county recorder charges. There's a second aspect that I think people kind of forget about. So let's tie this into some creative financing.
Okay. And
tell me your thoughts about this. So if I buy a property that I want to hold, okay? And I buy it subject to all-inclusive contract for deed, it really doesn't.
So a seller matter. Financing type deal.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. But there's an underlying loan that we've wrapped uh-huh. or taken over, okay? Everyone is so afraid of the what?
Dewan's outcome.
That's right, right? So
stop being afraid of the outcome. That's the first suggestion.
I'm with you. But at the same time, I wouldn't suggest you call up the bank and say, hey, I want to transfer that's this right. property.
Yeah.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah,
right?
Don't call the bank.
Yeah, okay. So let's put ourselves in a position where, we're protected as much as we can be protected. So if you now title this, like, the 123 Main Street
mm-hmm.
trust, with such and such as trustee, can the bank call that loan due? I mean, because there has been a title transfer.
Yeah. The due on sale clause in the Garn St. Germain Act, and this is where all this originates back in the 1980s, from a strict legal technical standpoint, transferring title to the house in the name of a trust that you, the investor, owns, does violate the due on sale clause.
Okay.
Because the exception under the due on sale, the due on sale clause says that if the house is ever sold to somebody else, then the bank has the right to call the note due.
Right.
Okay. In most transactions, sales transactions, the bank's paid off. So they don't care.
Right.
But in seller financing deals, the bank isn't paid off. So the loan's gonna stay there, but the house is sold. So almost in those situations, yes, the bank has the right to call the note due. Doesn't mean they will. Doesn't mean they have to. They just have the right to do that.
Yep.
So technically, whether you buy your name, a trust, or an LLC, the house is sold, and the bank does have the right to call the note due. But there's an exception to that.
Okay.
And that is you can stick your own property into a family living trust,
okay.
and that's an exception to the due on sale clause.
Okay.
And the reason being is you, the owner of that house, owns your family living trust. And so the house really hasn't sold.
Yep.
So when you buy in a trust on a seller finance deal, the title transfer, even though it did sell to a new person, on title, the only thing that is seen is the trust.
Right.
Which could lead, which doesn't necessarily mean the house is technically sold.
Right.
So the way we teach it is using a trust in seller financing deals lowers or reduces a red flag
absolutely.
To the bank.
Yep.
So it's just one more thing that we do in our seller financing deals to reduce the number of red flags.
Yep. So just in using this basic trust for very little money and actually a very little education that you need. I mean, you can learn this in 20 minutes, right?
Yeah.
You can stay anonymous
mm-hmm.
and you also put a little lack of red flags
yeah.
for the bank as mm-hmm. far as due on sale clause. Super good way to to one, start being introduced to trusts, and two, how to start structuring your business.
Right. Yeah, I that trust, this asset holding trust, is the world's greatest tool to pick up seller finance rentals.
Yeah.
Because your name will never appear on county land records. If you do it correctly, you start, you know,
yep.
You will be completely anonymous in holding that property forever.
Yep. Well, we talked at your presentation that you probably should use it regardless.
Yeah.
But if you're
there's a million reasons to use it, but that's one of them.
But if you're going to get a loan on this property, you now have to take the property in your own name, mm-hmm. so you can go get that financing, and then you put it in the trust. I mean, right. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what's
your name somewhere in the chain of time.
Yeah, I mean.
But you know, the nice thing is and I do this on my own personal residence, right? Instead of putting it into my family trust, which most people do, I put it into an asset holding trust that does not have my name on it anywhere.
Yeah.
And then that trust is owned by my family living trust. So technically it's in my family living trust, but my name is nowhere on title.
Yep.
If an attorney that's really good at digging is going to find the mortgage in my name and other things,
yeah.
But at least on title, it's got this completely other trust, a completely different trustee, and it will prevent liens from attaching to that property.
Yeah.
Even my own personal residence.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
So yeah, there's a lot of reasons to use these.
Yeah. All right. So
I said we would go back. People, how I own title to my house.
And I said we would go back. I said we would go back to this, but I know we're not going to go into this.
Okay.
But there are some ways to protect yourself in terms of wholesaling some properties, potentially using this type of trust or a disposable LLC. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I know you have a class coming up that you're spending an extra bonus hour dealing on.
Yes.
So I want everyone out there to know that, okay, real estate, I mean, these aren't even laws, but the guidelines, the rules, the governing body that's dealing,
interprets all of this.
Yeah, are constantly changing. Mm-hmm. I mean, 10 years ago, everyone was doing a simultaneous closing, right? We're using our buyer's money to fund our purchase first.
Right.
That's really not used much, if any, at all anymore.
Right.
Things change constantly.
That's why in real estate education is so important.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And so just because there's new things coming out about wholesaling and you can't assign or you can't do this, you can't do that, there's still ways of doing it and doing it in compliance.
Well, that's the brilliance of real estate investors.
Yeah.
We're always finding ways to get done what we want to get done.
Yep. Well, and that's why I wanted to have you on, is that exactly that, is that when you're looking for ways to, one, either protect your assets, mm-hmm. or two, to find ways to do things where you are doing them legally, ethically, and staying under the radar so that you're not getting yourself into trouble, you go to reputable people that know what they're doing.
Right.
So what I wanted to do really quick is talk about some of the things that you offer. And at some point, we're going to have a link to through our show to
stuff
that you
offer.
Yeah. But why don't you just talk about some of the things that you have coming up, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. Well, in my educational program, I do a lot of webinars. So these are nationally based. All you got to do is jump on the webinar. And they're usually free to $20-$25 in general. These are just great, basic, core ways to learn real estate investing.
Okay.
And the ones I've got coming up, this is actually March is Seller Financing Month, so we're kind of focusing on that. We've got some special deals going on. But next week, I've got a webinar on understanding the mortgage statement.
Okay.
So if you're going to do a seller finance deal that's wrapped or in some way around an online mortgage, you need to understand the terms and the things that are on that mortgage statement to better negotiate your deal. And so we're going to talk about, what information to get off that statement and how to apply that to actually getting the right deal, knowing what the terms of the underlying mortgage are, because it makes a difference.
Yeah, I just did one. We did somewhat of an episode.
And I'm amazed how many investors will go into a seller's finance and not even take a look at the note or the mortgage statement.
And I'm guilty of that, too. I don't really look at the note, but We literally just bought a property that I did not find out until after we purchased that it has an adjustable rate mortgage.
Yeah. Good learning experience.
Yeah,
huh?
It's not too big of a deal, but
depending on how long you're going to hold it and stuff. Yeah.
You'll look at it next time.
Yeah.
So that, and then, gosh, I don't know the date. Later in March is what I call issues in seller financing deal. So in other words, I've come up with 10 or 15 of the biggest mistakes that seller financers, you know, people who've done seller finance deals have made.
Yep.
As they've come to me as a lawyer to
yep.
fix these problems. And so I'm going to go over these 10 or 15 problems that you are, hiccups that you're going to encounter in seller financing deals and how to overcome them
okay.
in advance and how to prepare for them in advance. So you can sort of solve all these problems before they happen to you.
Awesome. That'd be really helpful.
Yeah, and we did something similar to that as well on an episode. And
yeah.
So,
learn from other people's mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now you get to hear from the attorney that helps all the people that need the help.
Yeah, so they come to Jeff, I get this, what do I do? I'm like, great, new learning experience. This is awesome.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got at least a couple of financing.
Yeah. I'm doing one on self-direction actually next Friday. I grew my retirement accounts 300% in 4 years.
That's pretty good.
So I'm walking through in a webinar every transaction that I did and exactly how I built it. So people can see what you can do in self-direction and how that builds your retirement wealth in a tax-free way. It's absolutely phenomenal. So self-direction is great. It's an advanced technique, but it's such a great tool.
Sure. And let's talk yep. about your trust class too.
And then I've got on March 23rd, Saturday, it's a live class. We are also going to stream it, which I've done in the past for students that are not in the state of Utah. There will be a live audience in there,
yep.
but my technology guy will just actually be filming it, and that filming will be transmitted online, kind of like a webinar would
yeah.
be. And so people outside the state can also participate and watch. And they're also watching the, you know, they can ask questions and stuff, just
yep.
like a webinar.
Yep.
It's on Saturday, March 23rd. We're going to talk about these three trusts, how they are used in real estate for protection and privacy purposes, and which is a general class that most people need.
Yeah.
Right? Just
if
understand.
You have any rental.
That's right. Any yep. rental, or you have a family, you got your family trust, you want more protection. Good core education.
Yeah.
These vehicles, these trusts, are a great way to facilitate real estate investment transactions. Seller financing deals, wholesaling deals.
Yep.
You can pool money with it. You can hold out-of-state properties in it. So we're adding on a bonus hour after I teach you the trusts and how to use them and what, you know, how to fill out the forms and stuff like that. I'm going to teach you how to assign a contract without assigning the contract via the trust, or exactly the steps you need to do to buy a seller finance deal where you're never on title.
Okay.
And how, if you got your pocket lenders, Mom and Aunt May and Uncle Joe, who want to give you $5,000, $10,000 each to help you do this flip project, and you want to make sure they're all kind of protected with a note or something, because they might be family, but they still want some kind of, you can use these trusts to kind of pool the money
yep.
in a very simple way.
Yep.
So it's a great transactional tool. And so that last hour we're going to go through, once you understand the trust, like, we're literally going to do deals.
Yeah, good.
And I'm going to paper the deal right in front of you.
Yeah.
And say, I'm gonna here's a purchase contract. I'm going to write in the name of the buyer. I'm going to sign it this. And then I'm going to go walk you through the closing and make sure your title company understands what they're doing and they do it correctly. And
yeah. So let me ask you really quick, and I don't mean to cut you off, but seriously, once you learn how to use, you know, you're not going to set up some of these. I mean, you're not setting up a family limited partnership. I mean, you're going to go get legal help to do that.
Yes, for those things, yes.
Yeah.
Family limited partnerships, the asset protection trust, those an attorney needs to
yeah.
do.
But yes. for the land trust, the asset holding trust, once you fill it out, I mean, do you have to keep coming back?
And, no.
I mean,
we sell the form.
Yeah.
So you buy the rights to use the form however you want.
So I mean, you pay once and you have it forever.
Forever.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are you charging for this?
$495.
Okay. I'm gonna be there. So
good.
It would be well worth your time, and you can help people. all across the country, right? I mean,
absolutely.
It won't matter that you're not from Utah.
80 to 90% of what I do across the nation.
Okay.
Yeah. Things, if you come in and say, hey, my tenant's suing me, the litigation kind of stuff, I can't do that, obviously. But yeah, these last upholding trusts I can do, LLCs I can do, family and partnerships I can do, protection trusts I can do,
Okay. And then you even have a bigger type education, correct?
It's the REI Master University. I found in all the real estate education that I've done over the last 20 years, which is phenomenal. There's people like, hey, learn how to make $100,000 a month in wholesaling. Learn how to be, you know, to save money in your next flip. And these are great because they're really kind of core real estate topics. But what I found is people leave these seminars and classes and they don't know how to actually conduct the transaction.
Yeah.
Like they don't know how to fill out a REPSI or a purchase contract if it's self-financed, or how to evolve or involve the underlying mortgage. And so they don't know how to put all, how to pay, we call it papery. Like they don't know how to paper the transaction and actually get it done.
Yeah.
And they're scared, and then they don't get in, they don't do transactions because they're too scared to bite the bullet that they're gonna do something wrong.
Yeah.
Like they know that they can wholesale and they know that they can market, but they don't know how to actually get it done.
Yep.
So what the Master University is actually that, where you're mastering the techniques by some 18 hours of video education, a textbook and workbook, and then an 8-hour day that is like showing up at a university class and being prepared with the readings, being prepared with the homework, and then we're going to get into the details and we're going to teach clients how to actually paper things and go through transactions so that they can walk out of there and walk up with any seller and be fully confident that they can sign a contract and lock it down and close the deal.
Cool.
That's awesome.
And we're covering all, we're talking wholesaling, seller finance, private lending, landlording, flipping, self-direction, pretty much every topic in real estate investment is covered in this university class.
Yep.
Sweet.
And you have all kinds of forms, addendums for seller financing, lease options, leases in general.
Sandwiches,
Master lease, I mean, on and on and on.
On and on. Pretty much anything a real estate investor needs, I've done it because I'm an investor as well.
Yeah, and one I saw was a joint venture, which you know,
you
absolutely want to make sure that is like done right.
Yeah, because partnering real estate is kind of booming. Everyone, because it's a great way to do more deals.
Yeah.
And combine talents or money or whatever. So partnering brings up some additional issues. So you definitely, if you're going to partner with somebody else, you've got to have some kind of partnership agreement or joint venture or something to lock it down. But again, these forms, and once you get experience in real estate, you don't need a lawyer.
Yeah.
To be totally honest.
Yeah.
You know, my biggest clients only talk to me a couple times a year.
Yeah. Yeah. But you better know how to do
yes. It's that education, you know, learn what you're doing, get some experience with it, and then you can just fly on your own.
Yep.
Absolutely. You know what I love about you, Jeff Braleo, is that you simplify things and you clearly explain how the process works, just like you walked us through the trust.
All right.
So, guys, those of you out there that are looking for this education, Jeff is compiling all this onto a new website. He just bought a new domain. That's REI Mastery U.com. So REIMasteryU.com. And if you guys go there in the near future and nothing's up, it's coming very soon. So stay tuned. And I've viewed your online store, Jeff, and there is so much there. You have such a thorough library on all topics of real estate investing. So highly recommend it.
It's good for 20 years.
There you go.
That's awesome.
Any other questions, Jonathan?
No.
I think we covered a lot in a short amount of time.
Yeah, I think you walked through that very well. That was
I think the asset holding trust or / land trust, you know where you're at, is one of the most underutilized tools in real estate. It's a little intimidating. I think people, I get why people are a little.
But it's really simple.
But once you kind of get past that fear of what it is and learn it, you're like, oh my gosh, I could use this for everything.
Super simple.
And what's funny is that as you were sitting there explaining that, I was like, I need this right now. So we're gonna talk after this. Yeah, because I'm at that point. You know, you say you know your clients, you grow with your clients. So I'm at that point where I need that asset holding trust. So.
Well, and you just got married, so and we actually talked about no prenup.
Set
things up.
even if you're single, that is a great time to start your planning because 50% of marriage is still in a divorce. You set it up separately before you're married, you can keep that separate and keep it out of your hands of your ex-wife.
Well, cool. Jeff, how else can people find you? Those who are in Utah and want to use you right away, give us your contact info and nationwide.
Yeah. Like I said, we can set up LLCs all over the nation. So that's, in fact, we do. So phone number is 801-560-2180.
One more time.
801-560-2180.
Okay.
They can also email me at jeff@breglialaw.com. So J-E-F-F. At my last name is spelled BREGLIO, then LAW.com, all one word.
Cool.
And we will have some links through our podcast that you can go through to get to Jeff and everything else that he's offering.
Yeah, and I'm going to link up your URL in the show notes
of
this episode. So the REIMasteryU.com, I'll link that up in this episode under the show notes.
Perfect.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Jeff.
Awesome. No, thank you guys. You guys are amazing.
Okay. Any last words?
Nope. I think hopefully this is something very informative for our listeners.
Absolutely. You just dropped so much. So go back and listen to this, guys.
Yeah. Little by little, just keep learning.
Until next time, guys, create some terms.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.